Hey there, you're listening to Does Not Compute on the Spec Network.
I'm Sean Washington.
And I'm Paul Straw. This is what my voice sounds like. This seems like a really goofy thing to do, but people keep getting us confused. So, yeah, this is me. I'm the one who does the ad reads.
And I'm not really sure what to say here, so thanks for listening to the show. Now, everyone's feedback has been very encouraging for us, and we've really enjoyed talking to you all in the Spec Slack. So if you haven't yet, you should totally go to spec.fm/slack and join us.
Alrighty. So I am Paul.
And I am Sean.
Hope you enjoy the show.
I have a number of larger applications coming up through the pipeline, and I'm taking a little bit of downtime that I might have before they actually start to kind of do a post-mortem on some of the other applications that I've worked on and think to myself, you know, what went well, what didn't go well, and trying to, take some notes as to what I can do better next time around.
I think that's really sensible. We've kind of mentioned before that it makes a lot of sense to look back at your previous dev work as an inspiration to see how far you've come, but also to kind of see how quickly you're growing. And I think in your case, that makes a lot of sense as well. If you're starting on some new larger projects, it's really good to look at similar ones from the past and see what was really good about them and what maybe wasn't great.
Right. One of the places where I've matured the most is in actually just using Ruby as opposed to trying to learn a whole lot about Rails. We talked a little bit about how learning the language that the framework is built upon will only help you learn the framework better. And in my case, I've been reading as many articles as I can and Googling like how to organize your code, how to keep your controller skinny, and how to just good Rails practices. And I've found that a lot of those articles actually just kind of fell back to Ruby concepts. And I realized, you know, if I'm not that strong of a Ruby programmer, then I'm going to have to rely on the conventions that I understand a lot more, which, you know, maybe that's not a bad thing, but there's definitely cleaner ways to do things. So one thing that I started doing was on Upcase, they have a bunch of Ruby challenges, and I started doing those. And that actually really helped. I never really sat down and tried to solve a word problem through code. And not only that, but I never really had anybody try to critique the code that I was working on. And I learned a lot from that process.
I think learning the language alongside a framework is so, so important, especially in Ruby, but kind of in every case. People, for a while, there was the whole thing with jQuery developers instead of JavaScript developers. And there's still a thing with Rails developers instead of Ruby developers. And it's so important. Knowing the language is just going to make your life easier, and it's going to make the code you output way better.
Right. So one of the reasons why a lot of people kind of jump for frameworks is because it kind of automates repetitive tasks and saves you time. And in doing that, the frameworks tend to do quote unquote magical things. I remember when I was first learning Rails, I'd ask you, like, how is this happening, or why does that work? And you would just say, it's just Rails just does it. It's part of Rails. I found that in learning Ruby, a lot of those magic things sort of make more sense now. They're not quite as perplexing to me.
In looking back at the projects you've done in the past, what have you actually found so far that you want to make sure you change going forward?
One of them, personally, is I'm going to try to come up for air more. For me, I can get lost in the application, I guess. So like when I'm hands down working on features, I can get into a tunnel vision state where I'm working on this feature, but I'm not necessarily paying attention to what's happening around it. And that can be a bad thing. So one thing that I'm going to actively try to do is just come up for air and look around at the other pieces more often. Another place where I found that I kind of went off course in the past was not fully understanding a feature before I started working on it. So I would go in and I would just like hit the ground running, start writing code. And then halfway through, I'd have to stop and ask questions or go back to the team and be like, how does this thing work again? And I would find that I didn't quite implement it correctly. And then I would have to make changes. That to me, so, you know, going and having to do that a few times can lead to pretty sloppy code.
That's one of the reasons that having a good spec at the beginning of the project is always super helpful. That's something, it can be very defined. It can be, you know, dozens of pages long and written by five people over the course of 4 months. Or that can be something as simple as, okay, here's this feature and I have an issue open in Git for it, and I'm going to write a paragraph about what it needs to do and then send that to, you know, whoever needs to sign off on that, whether it's a coworker or a client or whoever that happens to be. Having something written out in plain human language is really critical, I think. This helps solidify things. It allows non-technical users to see what exactly is going to be implemented and how it works. And it also reinforces your understanding as a developer of what the thing should do. Because sometimes you can say, okay, we need, let's say Twitter has the following model, and we need to do something similar to Twitter where users can follow each other. That sounds really simple when you just say it, but when you actually write it out, so many questions spring to mind. Is this something where people have to accept follows, like more of a friend request sort of thing? Is there a concept of blocking or any sort of security? Can people have their accounts set to private, so you have to request to be able to follow them, but normally you can follow anyone? There are so many different things that come up as soon as you start actually putting this stuff on paper, or in words at least, that really make it clear just how complex even a simple seeming feature can be.
I found it really helpful to show people early and often. And what I mean by that is I will take a prototype of something that I'm working on and I'll go to a few designers who aren't even on the project and I'll say, hey, what do you think of this? Does this make sense to you? Or sometimes I'll just bring my laptop over and I'll set it on the table and say, do this thing or try to use this. And I get a lot of really good feedback just because they're not familiar with things. They don't approach it, you know, from the mindset of knowing. They're just experiencing this for the first time. I mean, I even do that with my girlfriend. I'll text her a link and I'll say, hey, check this out. What do you think? And I get so much useful feedback from her because she doesn't look at things through the mind of a developer or a designer. She's just using this thing. And so she just gives me raw and honest feedback.
Yeah, what you're talking about actually has a name. It's called hallway testing. And basically the concept is you've got your laptop, you've got some code running on it, and you just walk down the hallway, you know, to the break room or wherever. And along the way, if you see somebody, you stop them and say, hey, can you try this? Let me watch you try this feature out. And then you just get to see somebody who is thrust into the middle of this application and doesn't really have any idea what's going on, how they interact with the app, and if the feature makes sense to them as an outsider, which is a really good indicator.
Yeah, it's really been humbling for me too, because I'll build things and I'm thinking to myself, yeah, I did a really great job on this and it works really well. And I'll send it to somebody else and they just say, I don't understand. And it really forces me to reevaluate, you know, how I'm looking at this thing, how I'm thinking about it. So I've had a lot of kind of humbling experiences by doing that. But I think that's really great. And there's a lot of things that I've learned because of that. Another area that I'm trying to focus on in the next round of applications is just simplicity and simplifying my code. Again, you know, mentioning Thoughtbot, I glean a lot from them. And one thing they teach is you should have small methods, short methods. And I've realized in looking at older code, I would write longer methods with lots of conditionals in them. And those can be really difficult to refactor and really difficult to follow. So one thing I'm actively trying to do is, you know, if a method is longer than, say, 10 lines, then split it out into two and try to isolate functionality and then have methods that really are responsible for doing one thing and one thing only.
That always kind of sounded goofy to me when I was a little bit newer to programming. Like, oh, 10 lines, that's so small. I'll just make it, you know, 20 lines or 30 lines or 40 lines. And pretty soon you have these massive methods that do so many different things. And they're really difficult to refactor because you don't even know what all is going on inside of them. And they're also extremely difficult to go back and read. When you're writing them, it generally tends to make sense, even if it's a pretty long method, because you're there in the moment, you have it all stored in your head, and it's just present for you. But when you go back 2 months, 6 months down the line, and you try to look at that code again, pretty much every time you are going to be very confused for at least a few minutes.
Right. I found that I would have bugs happen and I would spend so much time walking through each path and debugging, like, all right, did it happen in this path? Okay, well, let me go to the next conditional. Did it go bad there? No. Okay, well, let me go to the next one. It was such a frustrating experience, and I would change code and not realize that would obviously affect how the other conditionals run, and it just become a mess really quickly. So that's one thing I'm trying to focus on. Just like laser focus on this thing is, you know, simplify my code, simplify my methods. And I mean, quality can only go up from there.
Another really great way in Rails to kind of eliminate some of the bloat that you tend to get is to break things out into just plain old Ruby objects or poros. This is basically going beyond just the standard models, views, and controllers that Rails gives you out of the box, and going in and just modeling your own classes as necessary to represent business objects in your application. So for example, in an app I'm working on right now, I have a homepage class. It's pretty short. Right now, I think it's 15 or so, maybe 20 lines for the entire class definition. And basically all it does is on initialization, it grabs a few different models from different places, assigns them to attributes on itself, and then just sits there, does nothing. It's very, very simple. The only reason it exists is to get data for the homepage in a clean way. So now the controller action where that gets spit out is one line. It's literally just render JSON homepage.new. And all of that logic for that thing doesn't have to exist in the controller, and it doesn't have to be shoehorned into a model where it doesn't really belong. It's just in a what I would call a non-active record model. I think this is something that can be kind of intimidating with Rails because there's not a place that feels right necessarily to put this kind of stuff. There's obviously you have your app directory with models, views, and controllers, but those sort of feel like they're reserved for true Rails objects. And I don't think that necessarily has to be the case. There's actually a great article I just read called A Way to Organize Poros in Rails. And the author goes over several different options on how to do this. The first one is moving everything to the lib directory, which can definitely work, but tends to be kind of a junk drawer. The second option that he discusses is non-active record models. I think that this can make sense. Like in the case of the homepage that I have, it really is a model in the computer science sense, not in just the Rails sense. So I just put it under models. It's just models homepage.rb. The third one is use cases and entities, which basically splits your non-Rails stuff into use cases, which are verbs, and entities, which are nouns. This is a really interesting pattern, but it's also not very Railsy, so I'm staying away from that personally. And then the final one, which I thought was very interesting, is the concept of namespaces. Most Ruby code in gems and non-Rails things is written out with namespaces. So the idea here is that, let's say you have a dashboard controller. Then you would obviously have your controllers dashboard controller.rb, but then next to that, you would make a new folder called dashboard controller. And then under that, you could have your own custom classes. In the example on the blog post, there's a user list class that is just namespaced under dashboard controller. So then from within dashboard controller, you can just do user list.new and pass in whatever attributes, and it keeps that code clean. I think this is potentially a really good option depending on what you're trying to do, but I also feel that it kind of tightly couples things together.
Yeah, and looking at the example, it's extremely tightly coupled. In fact, to even use user list anywhere else, you would have to go through the dashboard controller, which would not really feel great.
Yeah, that's definitely a bit of an anti-pattern. So I think that this has its uses for sure, but I would be very careful about following this pattern. In general, I think the safest way to go is just to put things in the models folder if it makes sense as a model, or probably just in lib otherwise. There are so many conventions for this, which is strange in the Rails world. So it shows you just kind of how divided people are on this topic. But all that being said, it really does make sense to break out what you can in a Rails app into separate pieces that are more modular and can just be moved around. And plain old Ruby objects are great to work with.
Even just making things smaller like that, splitting isolated functionality into a separate file, it makes it so much easier to concentrate on. You don't have to, you're not distracted by a whole bunch of other methods. So if you have, for say, a model that's just huge or a controller that's too big, you know, I tend to get distracted by looking at other things. I could say that I'm very easily distracted, which is something I need to work on. But, you know, splitting that out allows me to really just focus on that functionality and look at what's going on there and not be distracted by anything else.
I think it's really important to remember that pretty much anything can be split out in this way. Friend of the show, Joe Sims, actually was recently helping me with the project, and he split out the sales tax on purchases into a separate model. So when you're calculating the sales tax for something, you actually just do sales tax.new and then pass in some attributes from the purchase itself, and it calculates all sorts of stuff for you in that class. And it's really nice because that class just has the one job. And then if you need to look up sales tax in a report or something, or use it anywhere other than a purchase, it's entirely modular and can just be moved around really easily. Don't think that something necessarily has to be huge in order to be broken out. A lot of things can benefit from being split out into their own class.
Well, I guess that's why the Unix philosophy works so well, right? I mean, you have small modules that are responsible for one thing, and that's all they're responsible for. And you build a larger system based off of those small modules.
Absolutely. Do one simple thing really, really well. It's a great philosophy.
I've been using that idea a lot of my front end work, you know, obviously using Vue and making components, making lots of small components that make up a bigger UI. And even, you know, even without Vue, when I'm working on things that can just be done in plain JavaScript, what I end up doing is just creating a class. Well, I mean, using CoffeeScript, I'll just create a class for that. And so the functionality for that piece of the UI is completely self-contained, and it just works out really, really well. So I'm really excited to kind of take these ideas and build upon them in my back-end work.
All right. I've been really excited to talk about this, and I finally get to, so I'm very stoked. Ruby 2.3 is getting really close to release. I don't know exactly when it's coming out, but preview 1 was released on November 11th, so it should be very soon. Perhaps even by the time this episode is out. We shall see. We'll have that in show notes either way. There are some really nifty new things that I personally am very much looking forward to.
What are you looking forward to the most about Ruby 2.3?
There's two major things that I'm really stoked on. The first one is the safe navigation operator. This has been a long time coming, in my opinion. It's something similar to what we have in CoffeeScript already with the question mark. So for people who aren't familiar with CoffeeScript, they have what's called the existential operator. It's just a question mark. And basically what it lets you do is check if a thing exists in a safe manner. So for those of you who aren't familiar with CoffeeScript, it has what's called the existential operator. This is just a question mark, but it allows you to do some really cool things depending on the context. So let's say you've got a variable called episode count, and it is currently set to 0 because you have no episodes. In regular JavaScript, if you typed if episode count, that would evaluate to false because episode count is 0, which is a falsy value. But in the case of a number, you generally don't want that to be falsy. So you can use the existential operator. If you do episode count question mark, CoffeeScript will actually turn it into a check if episode count is undefined and a check if it is null. So it expands that into a bunch more code. If you had a function and you did function name question mark and then parentheses, it will check not only if that function exists, but also if it is actually a function. So there's a bunch of different cool things that you can do with this in CoffeeScript, and Ruby is getting something very similar. So in Ruby, this is going to be the ampersand dot operator. If, for example, you have a user that sometimes has an address that always has a zip code, for example. So it's user sometimes has an address, always has a zip code. Then normally, if you wanted to get the zip, you might do something like if user and user.address and user.address.zip code. and then in that case, spit out user.address.zipcode. But with the safe navigation operator, you can go user.address.zipcode. And it will always give you either nil if something in that chain doesn't work, or it will give you the actual zip code back if you can get to it. I think this is a really cool operator, and it definitely has quite a few use cases. But I would say you want to be careful with it. If you're doing nil checks like this all over your code, that's generally, in my experience at least, a sign that something might need to be refactored in your code. It has its uses for sure and can be a very, very good thing to have in your toolbox. I do use it occasionally in CoffeeScript, and when I use it, it's always great to have. And I'm sure I'll do the same in Ruby. But when you are using features like this, I do recommend being careful.
That reminds me of some discussions I've been having lately with other front-end developers talking about why they essentially don't use SAS anymore, or why they don't recommend that people use SAS, and instead they recommend PostCSS. And I've asked a few of them why that is, and the answer I keep getting is that SAS allows people to misuse the powers that it gives you. For example, nesting things too deeply, like having four or five deep nested classes. And because of that, they say, you know, why not just remove the temptation to do that altogether by using PostCSS? I guess I could see the point there, but in my opinion, instead of removing the temptation altogether by getting rid of the feature, I would opt for training myself to use that feature responsibly.
Exactly. I think this, once again, comes back to learn your tools. Learn your tools inside and out. Learn when things are good to use, when things are not so good to use. And that will make you so much better all the time. There are so many places this helps. If there's a feature that can be dangerous, but can also be very handy, don't throw the feature out. Learn when it's dangerous and learn why it's dangerous, and then figure out how to avoid that. And also learn when it can be very useful. All right, the second bigger feature in 2.3 that I'm really excited about is the dig method on array and hash. So array and hash digging are very similar to what we just talked about with safe navigation. So let's say, again, you have a user with that might have an address that might have a zip code. You can do user.dig address zip code, and it will always return either the thing or a nil value if the thing doesn't exist. But it's, again, kind of the concept of safe navigation bundled up into a handy little method. So I think those are both going to be pretty nifty tools that we're going to have coming to Ruby very soon.
You know, we were talking about learning the languages behind frameworks earlier in this episode, and I came across a really awesome website, or at least I think it was awesome, earlier this week, and it's called bestruby.com, best-ruby.com. And I've really been on a quest to deepen my Ruby knowledge because it can only help my Rails chops. And this site is great for giving you a number of tips and tricks on doing things the Ruby way. That's also known as idiomatic development, when you're learning language-specific ways of doing things.
I just wanted to point out that this also helps with the learn your tools thing. This is a great site to learn how people use Ruby as a language in practice and get that kind of deep knowledge. Like you were saying, idiomatic.
This site is full of common programming patterns, but it shows you, first of all, the kind of the generic way to do them. And then after that, it shows you the Ruby way of doing them. For example, section 2.1 in the sidebar is each versus map. And the first part shows you how you could just loop over an array of user IDs using users.each. And that's fine. But you could and probably should use the map method, which is much more concise and I think easier to read.
All right. So the last thing we wanted to talk about is this really nifty article from Honey Badger. This article is called How Ruby Interprets and Runs Your Programs. And it's a really interesting look at kind of the behind the scenes of how Ruby actually parses and executes Ruby code. It's a very cool look into this sort of thing, especially if you haven't looked at how programming languages work a little bit more behind the scenes before. It goes through tokenizing, like how it actually splits every little thing out into its own piece. Lexing, which takes the tokens and adds some metadata to them, like their location as well as the type of thing that they are, basically. And then it gets parsed and compiled to bytecode, which then runs on the virtual machine. And you can, when you get down to the bytecode level, you can actually see that the Ruby that actually gets run on your computer kind of looks way more like assembly than it actually does Ruby code. And this is a very non-technical as this sort of thing can get anyhow, look at how Ruby looks at itself, which is, I think, really, really cool to see. Another really nifty thing to check out in the same vein, if you're more of a front-end person, is the CoffeeScript source code. CoffeeScript is actually, first of all, written in CoffeeScript, which is pretty neat. And secondly, it is fully annotated source. So it's similar to Backbone or a couple other libraries where they have the source code on the right and then full-on documentation and explanation of what's going on the left. So you can see actually how that programming language, CoffeeScript, was built up from the bottom. We'll have a link to this in the show notes, but I think this stuff is super interesting to look through. And even if you don't want to make a programming language personally, it's kind of neat to see what's going on and understand how they work at least a little bit more.
Yeah, this sort of thing has always been fascinating to me. I mean, I have a hard enough time telling a computer how to work in plain English, let alone, you know, understanding what goes on behind the scenes.
I think one of the coolest things for me is just seeing, like in this Honey Badger article, the program that they are using to explain this is a one-liner, a very simple one-liner, just using a ternary. And by the time it's bytecode, you're looking at something that's like 18 lines long. And it's just kind of incredible how much processing goes on to take it from something that a human can read to something that a computer can execute.
A lot of, you know, looking at these lower level sources for this, it reminds me of learning how to program in high school where our teacher had us write out flowcharts on paper.
What language were you working in?
QBasic. I remember my final project in that class, I made the game where there's two basically cannons and there's a hill on each side and the cannons shoot at each other.
Scorched Earth.
Yeah, Scorched Earth. And if you miss, it takes a chunk out of the other hill. And then obviously if you hit the other cannon, you win. But it was a lot of fun.
We should have a link to Scorched Earth in the show notes.
I would never stop playing it.